I never played Mario.
Oh, what?
Yeah. I love those two different reactions. You were like, oh, what do you mean? And I'm like, yeah, tracks.
This is a Particle Podcast. WA Science, told different. Powered by SciTech.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Morgan.
And I'm Leon.
And I'm Beth.
And welcome to Please Look Up, your monthly deep dive into space news.
And commentary.
Recorded at SciTech on Whadjuk Noongar land.
Wait a minute, that's the producer.
That's producer Morgan.
Get out of here, Morgan.
What's going on? Oh, Leon, it's April.
Oh, and Morgan is the April Fool?
Yeah, always. I mean, maybe the perpetual fool, but he's laughing, so this is all okay. But yeah, welcome everyone to April.
It's that time of year already.
Oh my goodness. The time, it keeps going and going and going and getting past me.
So I think we might just launch straight into it. Tell me, Beth, what's up this month?
It's so exciting to hear you say that. It's all topsy-turvy, but it's quite fun. So, we're watching the sunset, as we like
as
to do.
As we always do.
In the west, as it always is. If you're watching the sun setting in the east, something has gone horribly wrong.
You're having a very bad day.
So, sun setting in the west, and we are actually going to turn left.
Yes, we've been turning to the right for the past couple of months to look up to the north, but to the left this month.
Yeah, we're going to turn left, so we're facing south, mm-hmm. and then a little bit more to face southeast, where rising above the southern horizon. I don't know why I've gone David Attenborough, but I have. rising above the southern horizon returns to our skies in its full height, the Southern Cross, which of course marks the rising of the Milky Way.
No, that's probably enough of that.
Yeah, this is what happens when we record in the morning rather than the afternoon, is you get slightly unhinged morning, Beth.
Beth's morning coffee hasn't worn off yet. So the Milky Way is appearing in the southeast.
Yes.
And it's marked by the Southern Cross, you mentioned.
Yeah, so it's fairly common in Australia for people to know about the emu that is hiding in the Milky Way. Its face is actually the Coalsack Nebula, which is actually a sort of dark patch in the Milky Way, which is why it's called the Dark Emu, because it's not the Milky Way itself, it's all the dark patches in it, which are actually clouds of dust and gas in space blocking the light from the stars in the Milky Way.
Mm. And the Coalsack Nebula is like just underneath the Southern Cross.
Well, I like to think that the emu is wearing the Southern Cross as a crown.
Ah, okay.
Yep. Yeah. That's so the pointer stars are its neck.
Yep.
And then his little crown is the Southern Cross on its head.
Ah, there we go. That's a pretty good idea, actually. Because it's kind of hard. It's not until you have seen the emu that you realise just how large it is. And
yeah.
You go and look at the Southern Cross and you're like, that gives you a perspective that if that is essentially the size of the head of the emu.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And so that's appearing up in the southeast.
Yeah, in the southeast. So we're still not that far above the horizon. Like, we have been able to see the Southern Cross fairly consistently, but not very well, because it's been very, very low on the horizon. Yeah. So, you know, if there's lots of tall trees around you, you probably won't have been able to see the Southern Cross for a few months. But we're getting to that time of year where the Southern Cross becomes our sort of dominant feature in the night sky. Mm. And, yeah, with it comes the emu.
Comes the emu.
And the Milky Way.
Yep. Now, it's worth mentioning that this is very much a dark sky pattern to look for.
Yeah. If you are in central Perth, you'll be able to see the Southern Cross, so you'll know that you're looking at the Milky Way, but you won't be able to see it.
No. However, perfect timing, because, of course, April brings with it Easter, and yes. I'm sure a lot of people might be planning on getting out of town for a bit.
Oh, especially with that, like, whole you can take 3 days leave to get 10 days off thing that's happening this year with the lineup of...
I haven't put my form in.
Oh, no!
Oh, I might be too late for that one.
Leon, get the leave request in. Yeah. Quick, go!
But yes, if you are getting out of town for Easter, going camping or whatever, make sure you get a chance to look at the Milky Way and the emu from a dark sky, because once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Yeah, also this time of year is quite nice because it's often, even though the Milky Way is still fairly low in the sky, we're less likely to have cloud cover still at this time of year. Whereas like when you get into peak Milky Way season, which is sort of going into May, June, we're more likely to have rain and clouds.
Yes, that's right. So when we say the Milky Way is quite low in the sky, we're talking about in the evening, 9 p.m.
Oh, yeah, if you stay up late
till 2 in the morning,
yeah,
you'll see the whole thing stretching across the sky.
Yeah.
Which is going to be awesome.
Yeah. So I'm saying that the Southern Cross is rising and becoming the more dominant feature in our night sky, and that's partly because our previous dominant feature for the past few months is sort of setting.
Yes, that's right. So for the past few months we've been telling you to go outside, face west, and then turn to the right.
Yes.
And looking to the north and see Orion and friends.
Yes,
up in the
Orion
northwestern
and Taurus,
sky.
Canis Major, Canis Minor.
Yeah. So yeah, you're right. They're still there, but now's your last, you know, good month to get a good look at Orion.
The Pleiades in Taurus are already super low on the horizon just after sunset. So yeah, Taurus is already sort of fading.
Yep.
But yeah, Orion, it's your last sort of month to spot.
Yeah. And to clarify that, so if you've started out, as we've always suggested, facing the west and having listened to what Beth has just said, we've turned to the left and looked at the Southern Cross.
Yep, so we're looking southeast.
Yep, and then we turn back and face back to the west, to our right, and then we just keep turning to the right and now we're facing northwest.
Unless you want to just, like, keep turning left until you're all the way back at the northeast, but that might...
Yeah. but yeah, so you can still see Mars and Jupiter up there as well.
Yes.
They are in and nearby. So Jupiter is in Taurus, so it's sort of to the lower left of Orion, and Mars is actually moving quite far across the sky this month.
It
kind of hangs where it is in the sky, but the background stars are moving out of its way. And so Mars will be there in the northwest as well.
One of the things that I like to think about with Jupiter is it's between Taurus's horns.
Yes,
but also the way that it sort of looks, I always think that Taurus looks a little bit like a crocodile. Antares is still one of the eyes. But
those big two.
But the two big prongs are the mouth instead.
Instead of the horns.
So the crocodile that is Taurus is eating Jupiter at the moment.
There you go. I think you've probably invented a more realistic Australian interpretation of that pattern of stars.
So Jupiter and Mars looking pretty good. Uranus, again, right low on the horizon. So
yeah, it's there, but there's better times of year later on to have a look at Uranus.
The planetary parade is over.
It's over.
They have gone home. They've gone to bed.
Do you know where you can see half a parade, though?
Half a parade?
Yeah.
A para?
Yeah.
Where can I see the para?
The para is... it's in the morning now.
Oh, no, not the morning, Leon. That's my least favourite time.
If you're one of those monsters who's a morning person, you can actually still catch the remainder of the planets. But yes, they are in the east. So you either stay up all night or you get up really, really early.
Okay, so watching for the sun rise this time rather than the sunset. So facing the direction you would at sunrise.
Yes, and if you're out before sunrise this month, you can see Mercury, Venus, and Saturn.
Oh.
All there. So what happened is during the parade of planets the last couple of months, they were in the western sky at night.
Yes.
And then they went behind the sun, or Mercury in front of it. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, Venus and Mercury went in front of it. Saturn went behind it.
Yeah.
Point is, they've come out on the other side.
Right.
Due to their motion and Earth's motion. And because they're on the other side of the sun, we have to wait until the sun is on the other side of the sky to see them.
Yeah.
Which is why we're now looking at them in the morning.
Right.
And you can also technically see Neptune there as well.
If you have a telescope.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. A really good day to go out would be the 25th or the 26th of April before sunrise, because the moon will be there as well.
Oh.
So you'll be able to see four planets and the moon all within a handspan of each other.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is pretty cool.
Is it a big moon that will make it harder to see the planets?
No, it'll in fact be just the barest little fingernail of a moon.
Perfect.
So yeah, it's actually a pretty good time to go and see it. So yeah, about 5:30 in the morning would be a good time to go out.
Amazing. I mean, not amazing at all, because there is absolutely no way that I'll be there at 5:30 in the morning. So if you guys can all go out and take some really good pictures so that I can see it when I wake up at a reasonable human time, that would be great.
Yep.
So I think that talking about these morning planets leads us in quite nicely to our next in our series of star stories.
Star stories, yes.
I'm a star! A great big shining star!
Beth, I don't know much about Saturn. Wouldn't it be convenient if someone who was an expert in this sort of mythology were to tell me a little bit about Saturn, because I don't know much about it.
Wouldn't it just? Well, Leon, I had a little bit of a look about Saturn. So Saturn's quite fun, and by fun, I mean fun in the Greek myth sense, which means
awful.
Full of horrible things. So Saturn's a little bit of a weird one.
Mm-hmm.
He is the god of time,
yes,
wealth, agriculture, the capital, and liberation.
That's a interesting portfolio.
Yeah, it's really weird. And it's so interesting, though, when you start to dig into this, all of the symbolism that has, like, proceeded through everything. So even there is conversation that death wielding a scythe is to do with Saturn.
Really?
Because it's about the passage of time, which includes death, but also agriculture, which is the scythe.
Oh, wow. I'd never put those two together before.
Yeah. So there's some really weird, and obviously when you're talking about mythology and symbolism that's coming from it, what tends to happen is it's actually several different stories conflated, and it's just like whichever that individual person's like personal history and personal connections
of the time.
I'm not saying like for everyone this is the reason why death is portrayed like this. Mm-hmm. But yes, that is one potential theory as to why death appears with a scythe.
There you go. Yeah, I'm only really familiar with Saturn and time because obviously Kronos is the Greek.
Yes. Yeah. So often conflated with Kronos, which is where we get a lot of the words around time. So like chronic and like chronology,
things like that.
Yeah, all to do with time. But what's quite fun when you're talking about this Greek and Roman stuff is the Roman gods did sort of exist independently of the Greek for a time. And then when Rome conquered Greece, they just sort of went, yeah, sure, we'll just assign all of those traits. So Saturn then took on a lot of the... because it's like, oh, these are both our time gods, so we're just going to sort of mush their mythologies
together. Yep.
So Saturn, as with many of these very ancient figures, had a sibling wife. So Saturn's was Ops.
Ops.
Yeah, probably more familiar is the Greek term in this case, which is Rhea.
Ah, yes. Rhea is actually a moon of Saturn.
Yes. So we'll get to them. Oh, don't worry, Leon.
We will get to the moons.
Now, the children of Saturn are very familiar to anyone who knows anything about planets. So among Saturn's children, we have Jupiter, Neptune, Pluto, Juno, and Ceres.
There you go.
Loads of planets slash dwarf planets slash... space missions.
Yeah.
Now, Saturn...
So is this where, like, the phrase old father time comes from?
Sort of, this whole, like, passage of time, like, Saturn is often depicted as an old man. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of, there's also this whole thing where Saturn ate his children.
Yes, he did, didn't he?
Yeah. So there was a prophecy that Saturn would be killed by one of his children. So he ate them all.
He ate them all, yes.
But then there's also this like conflation where it's like, oh, but that's time devouring his children because it's like children get old and they're not always children.
It's a metaphor.
Oh, metaphorical.
I'm sure you've seen the picture though. Have you seen
the Goya Saturn devouring his son?
Yes. If anyone listening has not Googled Saturn devouring his son, it's a good way to give yourself nightmares.
Yeah, it's fairly memed at this point, okay, so you're probably fairly familiar with it, even if you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, like creepy giant eating someone's head. Yeah.
Ugh.
But yes. But then Jupiter, depending on which story you look at, or Zeus, was the last born and went, oh no, and then like fed Saturn rocks and then cut the other kids out of the...
Yeah, that's right. The story I heard was Jupiter's mother... when Saturn demanded to eat the child, she gave him a rock instead. And
yes.
Jupiter was raised elsewhere and then came back and overthrew Saturn.
Yes, and like because gods don't die, they were all just still there
just
chilling
fine.
In
yeah.
his tummy. And they were like, okay, so I don't know what the point of eating. And then, of course, Saturn does die, but not really, but is killed by it.
Yeah, I don't know.
But the word Saturn crops up in a lot of places. So Saturday...
Yes.
Yeah, Saturn's Day.
Saturn's Day.
Which is also a little bit weird and a little bit fun because of just how we call days of the week is that most of them are actually based on Norse mythology.
Really?
Yeah.
All
so
right, let's go through it all. Saturn's Day.
So we've got Saturn's Day. And then Monday is just Moon Day.
The Moon Day. Sunday is obviously the Sun's Day.
Sunday is Sunday. But then Tuesday is Tyr's Day. So Tyr, T-Y-R. Being one of the Norse gods. Wednesday is actually Woden's Day.
Yep.
Thursday is Thor's Day. Mm-hmm. Friday is Freya's Day or Frigg's Day.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so most of them, Norse. But then Saturn's up there
Saturn's
as well.
Saturn's up there.
Yep.
Why not?
Yeah, but maybe passage of time, days of the week.
Ooh, could be. Ooh. It's all connected,
yeah.
Man.
And then the other thing we've got is the Roman festival of Saturnalia. Now, Saturnalia took place in Rome between the 17th and 23rd of December. Now,
that sounds like a solstice festival.
It is a solstice festival, sort of a harvest festival. Again, passage of time, of course. Saturn was going to be associated with some sort of passage of time festival. Hmm. However, when Rome started becoming Christian, we've got this thing where we've got to merge all our festivals together because people are like, what do you mean I can't celebrate Saturnalia? And so there's sort of a theory that maybe Jesus' birthday was not actually on the 25th of December, but they kind of wiggled it there because people were going to celebrate Saturnalia anyway, and so they had to give people a festival to celebrate in December-ish times, so they made it that. But it means that actually quite a lot of the Christmas traditions are actually from Saturnalia traditions because people were going to do this stuff anyway.
There you go.
So we just kind of had to rebrand it.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite topical that you should point that out anyway, given that Easter is basically the same thing.
Yes, yes.
Festival of Ishtar or something?
There's
so many.
There's so many because all of these festivals, and the reason that they all line up as well, so like a lot of people notice that, especially before Christmas, you've got stuff like Hanukkah and Kwanzaa that all like tend to sort of fall around the same time, and it's because just of the way that people are, is that actually what we want is we want a harvest festival to celebrate having all of the food. We want a light festival to cheer us up in the middle of winter when it's all very dark. We want a, oh, thank God winter is over festival in the spring. Mm-hmm. Let's all be happy. And there's lots of babies everywhere, so let's be happy about those. And longest day. So basically the four solstices throughout the year. Yeah,
two solstices and two equinoxes.
Yeah. So many cultures have solstice and equinox festivals. Mm-hmm. And they have all merged and borrowed from each other because in a way, you know, your trade partner, maybe your historical trade partner, has a party at the same time. So they're selling you spices that are traditionally used in their festival. So it's like, okay, so we're going to incorporate some of those. And then you end up with situations like, what's a Yule log? And I was like, oh, actually, that's the festival of Yule, which is a Scandinavian thing, and it's collided with this Christian festival. So now that we've got both, we have Jesus and a log.
There you go. And so, as a result, it's unsurprising that many of the deities, not just across what we tend to focus on of Greek and Roman religion, but many deities appear throughout all of these stories interwoven.
Yeah, yeah, because they're all associated with those different times of year. Yeah. And obviously a lot of, because just historically like population is greater in the global north, most of those festivals line up with global northern seasons. There's, I'm sure, lots of different festivals associated with, and I mean, even if you look at the Aboriginal calendar, like most of that and most of the naming around the Noongar calendar in particular is about different activities at different times of year.
Yeah.
So yeah, the seasons are all based in practicality. So like the harvest festival is to celebrate the end of the harvest. It's Halloween, but that's always been like a harvest festival in the Northern Hemisphere because that's when you harvest things, whereas obviously in a culture where October time isn't the harvest time, then you're not going to have a harvest festival represented in their culture and mythologies.
Yep.
So, Saturnalia, Christmas, bringing us back.
Yep.
There's too many moons, Leon!
Too many moons.
Too many moons.
Yeah.
Also, I found a really fun phrase that I very much enjoyed in my research. Innumerable additional moonlets.
Innumerable additional moonlets. Yeah, so you... from the astronomical side of things, the reason Saturn is in the news lately is because it has just acquired another 128 moons.
Which is more moons than any other planet even has. So what nerve Saturn's got in...
It now has, 274 known moons. And so, that was interesting just because... Yeah, for a while there was a bit of a race between Jupiter and Saturn of like who had the most moons.
Well, and also my brain always goes, well, Jupiter must have the most moons because it's the biggest. It's so the biggest. Gravitationally it's bound to. Saturn's just like, well, if I can't be the biggest, I am the prettiest and I'm going to have the most moons.
Have the most moons. Yeah, see, when I first started presenting shows in the planetarium at SciTech...
Don't age yourself, Leon.
I know. I think it was Jupiter had 60 moons and Saturn had 50, 52 or 54 or something like that.
Yeah.
Known moons.
Yes.
And then, yeah, in the past, you know, several years, those numbers have gone up. And now Jupiter, we know of 96 moons. And then, yeah, Saturn was sitting at 136 for a while, and now it's up to 274. And that's mostly because of research from a reasonably small group of people who just consistently have been studying the outer gas planets over the past sort of 10, 15, 20 years. And, yeah, they have collected this data. They actually discovered these objects in 2023. But the reason it was in the news is that the IAU, the International Astronomical Union, has taken the time to study and consolidate their research and confirmed, yeah, actually that's a good scientific study. These moons are all real.
Yeah. I think it's a thing in general in science. Science done once is great, but science done three times with the same results is a fact. Kind of like...
Yeah, you need that five sigma significance.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting the way they did it, is because these newly discovered moons are of order like a couple of kilometres across.
Yes.
And keep in mind, Saturn is a billion kilometres away. So you're looking at, it's more than a billion. So you're looking at these, you know, the aspect ratio is one in a billion.
Yeah.
These
you're looking for a single pixel.
Yes.
And not smaller.
Yes, that's right. So the way they do it is you don't just take one image. It's not going to show up, not enough light. But yeah, they take many images over a period of time. And then sort of if the moon is moving throughout those images, then in each picture it'll be in a different pixel and you won't get anything. But what you do is you then digitally shift the actual images. If the moon is there, and once you've shifted the images, it'll be in the same pixel in every image then, and then you stack them all on top of each other, and that's how you pick the signal out of the noise. It's called the shift and stack technique.
Okay.
And they found 128 of these little moonies. the one thing that's
but
interesting...
But they are not moonlets.
No. Oh, we'll
moonlets
get to that.
Are something different.
Well, yeah. the one other thing is interesting is that a lot of these moons have, these newly discovered moons have similar orbits. Like they sort of fall into several families, which suggests they used to actually be one bigger object, which was then broken apart.
Yep.
Yeah, so it gives you clues to the violent history of the solar system.
Mm.
But yes, I think you said there's too many moons.
There are too many moons and innumerable additional moonlets.
Yeah. Yeah, and this has really kicked out the question of what is a moon? This comes back to the whole what is a planet? Because it's the case with anything in astronomy is the smaller they are, the more of them there are.
Yes.
At some stage, you know, these kilometre-sized objects, people are happy to call moons. But then, yeah, all of the, you know, suppose a few bits of material in Saturn's rings start to stick together. And instead of being kilometre-sized, it's maybe 20, 30, 50 metres across. That's where they start saying, oh, well, it's not a moon. It's a little baby moon. It's a moonlet.
Or are you just a big chunk of rock in a ring?
Exactly.
Yeah.
What is it? We don't really have a good answer of what is a moon apart from, you know it when you see it. But, of course, once you get down to the granularity of Saturn, where, you know, you have literally trillions of specks of dust, is every single thing that goes around a planet a moon? In which case, basically...
Are satellites moons? As in man-made satellites?
Well, I think it's the other way around. Moons are satellites. They're just natural.
Yeah.
but
is every natural satellite a moon?
Yeah, that's it. But we haven't really learned what a moon is. We've just learned a word.
Yes.
At the moment...
Well, and then there's moons.
Yeah, moons. A moon can have a moon that goes around it.
Yep.
I don't think we know of any just yet, but there's nothing that says you can't have that.
Yep.
We also know of several asteroids, many asteroids, that have moons as well.
Doesn't even have to be a thing that goes around a planet.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, actually. My God.
Yeah. In fact, we spoke about one last month with the DART, the asteroid collision test. It smashed into a moon of an asteroid.
Yeah.
But that's the news. Saturn has more moons now.
Now, I have a bone to pick
with
the International Astronomical Union about Saturn's moons.
Yeah.
So, only 63 of Saturn's 274 moons have names.
Mm.
So, we're back at names because it's me. Yeah. So, those names are some of the big famous ones are Titan, Rhea, and Janus. Janus is Saturn's brother. So originally, they were going to name them after Titans, Titanesses, and Giants, who are all somehow related to the mythological figure of Saturn.
Yeah.
They ran out.
Yes.
In the 20th century, so started naming them after Inuit and Gaelic gods and Norse ice giants. And then, my interpretation of this is the IAU then got bored and gave up. And they decided that they weren't going to name any of Saturn's moons under 3 kilometres in width unless they were scientifically important.
Oh, under 3 km, right.
Yeah, and I think that that is...
You're not standing for
it. No, I'm not standing for it. Things deserve names. So, I proposed that we start to name Saturn's moons after the New York Giants, members of the American football team. Think about this. Having a moon called Ulimunor.
Ulimunor.
Ulimunor. Who is a current member of the New York Giants. Don't worry, I checked his Wikipedia page. There is no controversy section.
Okay.
But, like, that sounds like a moony kind of name, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it was pointed out to me, a non-Australian, that we have local Giants, the GWS Giants. And so I had a look at the AFL team, the Greater Western Sydney Giants. Also, they have a female AFL team who are also called the Giants. Mm-hmm. And one of their players is called Zryker. Is that not just an awesome moon name?
Yeah, I guess so.
Zryker? Like, that sounds spacey. And she is also the first Muslim Lebanese descent woman in the AFL. I think she'd be a great person to name a moon after. And also, there are so many Giants players in history. I'm sure we can find 274 moon names.
You know what? That's not a bad suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Let's start a petition. Yep. Let's get it going.
Come on, IAU. Don't give up. Name all those little moons.
I think the naming convention is that whoever discovers it gets to propose the name, and then the IAU will then vote on whether to accept that name or not. So you can write to the people who discovered these moons.
I genuinely might.
Yep. Good luck with that. I believe there is a somewhere in there that says they have to be named after mythical deities or not temporary human things like that. There are asteroids and things that are named after people.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't say that the GWS Giants are temporary. Come on.
No.
They're a cultural cornerstone. I know nothing about AFL, so I don't know what I'm saying.
They're a relatively new team.
Oh, damn it. But yeah. I still think it would be cool. There's plenty of Giants. We're not going to run out of those.
Yeah. Okay. I see the thread of logic that runs through there.
Yeah.
I just don't think you're going to have much luck. It's good. Good suggestion.
We can, but try.
Oh dear.
So I think that's all I've got about Saturn, and it's way too many moons.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Beth. Still focusing on the night sky.
Uh-huh.
I want to talk about crabs.
Oh.
It's time for the constellation of the month.
Constellation of
Orion.
That's my crab noise.
Ah, yes. So Beth is emulating the, what is it? The
claws?
Claws. Yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
So the constellation of the month this month is Cancer.
Crab.
Yes, Cancer the crab, which, to get straight to the point, the Latin, ancient Latin for crab is Cancer.
Oh, see, I looked into this because it frustrated me. Because I was like, how have we ended up with these two words that, Cancer means a crab and also a tumour. Mm. And I was like, how has one thing come to mean two such different things? Have they come? Because quite often you look at this and it's like the same word and it's come from Latin and Germanic and it means two totally different things. Mm. And I know that cancers, like body cancer, was called, like, they were called cankers for a long time and like in like older English, and I was like, oh, so did cancer come from canker? And I literally just googled the etymology, and it was like, when I looked for cancer etymology, it was like from canker in old English and cancer in ancient Latin. And then I was like, okay, canker etymology, and it was like, comes from cancer in ancient Latin and cancer in English. And I was like, what do you mean?
This is the Wikipedia problem all over again.
So yeah, it turns out the word cancer just means crab and also just means tumor.
Oh, there you go.
But it probably comes from the Proto-Indo-European word, or like suffix or prefix, car. K-A-R, meaning hard.
That's, sure.
Yeah, so Proto-Indo-European is like the big mother language of, like, if you go back far enough, basically nearly all languages except for Finnish and Hungarian, basically, came from Proto-Indo-European, European even. So yeah, this car means hard, so I imagine cancer came from hard shell and
a hard lump, in your neck.
In your body.
So, there you go.
Yeah.
Well,
frustrated me. I went on a bit of a, like, just a circle. It was just a circle. It was like, cancer comes from canker comes from cancer. And I was what do you mean? So yeah, it just does mean both.
There you go. Now, if you want to find Cancer in the Sky.
Yes.
So it is a zodiacal constellation, zodiacal.
It is the dimmest of them all, though.
Yes, it's a very, very faint one. So you might actually be best looking for Jupiter and Mars to help you guide the way.
Okay, so we've watched the sunset in the west.
Mm-hmm.
We're turning right.
We're turning to our right to find Jupiter and Mars.
And Mars.
And then what you want to do is draw an imaginary line between them.
Okay.
Because what zodiacal or zodiacal means is if you plot the path of the planets and the sun over the sky, they don't just move anywhere. They actually move in a pretty consistent pattern across the sky.
Ecliptic.
The ecliptic, as it's called. And constellations that appear in the ecliptic are called zodiacal, zodiacal. And so to find Cancer, because it's a zodiacal one, you just keep drawing this line from Jupiter to Mars and then just a little bit further, maybe another handspan, and you'll find the region of the sky that we call Cancer the Crab.
Yeah, however, so you said it also means that if you're familiar with the other zodiacal constellations, if you found Taurus,
yes,
then you go on to Gemini,
yep,
and then next along is Cancer.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, if you prefer to do it that way.
Yeah.
For sure. Now, it is a very, very faint constellation, as you say. It looks like a capital Y in the sky.
Okay.
So, yeah, you just go out and look for a capital Y sort of just past Mars,
yeah,
and that's the sort of pattern. So in some drawings it's shown as like a, if you imagine the capital Y where the arms stick out the top,
yes,
if you imagine flipping that as well and having some, I guess, legs stick out the bottom.
Okay.
Sometimes it's also drawn like that,
right,
which might be to emulate the symmetry of a crab, you know, the claws on either side, things like that. So, yeah, it's a pretty interesting constellation. It's got two really, really noteworthy things in it. One that you can see with your background telescope, and one that you need something a little bit more sophisticated to see, but is really, really cool. There is a star cluster in it.
Ah, yes, an open cluster.
An open cluster.
The Beehive Cluster. So that's one of the nearest open clusters to Earth, and it's actually been known about for a very, very long time. So in Ptolemy actually wrote about it. The quote is, "Nebulous mass in the breast of Cancer."
Ah, there you go.
So, yes, so it appears to the naked eye as more of a nebula.
Like a fuzzy region.
Fuzzy smudge.
Yep.
But, yeah, so that's it. Where can we find it? In the breast of Cancer. You draw the crab, it's in sort of
it's
the middle.
Right in the middle of it, yeah. And so what does it look like if I point my little telescope at it or even just some binoculars?
Well, it's an open cluster, so it is a group of about 1,000 stars. I mean, you wouldn't be able to see all 1,000.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's if you're naked eye, you're just sort of looking at a smudge.
With some very basic equipment, you can definitely start to pick out some of those individual stars.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you say, 1,000 stars, yeah, you won't see 1,000. A lot of them would be too small and too faint.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you can definitely see some of the biggest and brightest ones.
Now, while I was researching the Beehive Cluster, I found a sentence which I didn't fully understand. This sentence was that the age and proper motion of the Beehive Cluster are similar to that of the Hyades, which is the group of stars that make up Taurus's face, which means that they may have similar origins.
Mm.
So the age bit, I understand. It's like, well, it's roughly the same age as these stars, so it might have come from the same place.
Yep.
What's proper motion? How does that play into all of this?
Yeah, proper motion's an interesting one. Astronomy has lots of really bad jargon. And proper motion's not too bad as on the scale.
Yeah.
Ask me about magnitudes one day.
But
proper motion is actually just it's angular motion across the sky relative to our solar system. So in the sense of they're typically very, very small, but it might be moving at, say, 1 degree per century, for example.
Okay. So, like, at the moment, the Hyades make up Taurus's face, but then maybe in, like, 3 million years, they will have shifted out of Taurus's face.
Yes, Taurus's face will be a different shape.
Yeah, that would mean that the Beehive Cluster at the moment, and also like 1,000 years ago, was in the breast of Cancer. But in several million years, it will have moved the same sort of distance across the sky that the Hyades will have.
Yes, that's it.
Because it's moved the same amount across the sky and it's roughly the same age, that sort of implies that it may have come from the same place.
Yeah, more or less. Because, when you look at the proper motion of just a random selection of stars across the sky, they're moving in any which way they want. And we actually can simulate this in the planetarium, where we can put like a long exposure on the stars and then wind the clock forward by 1 million years, and it just turns into spaghetti mess. However, when you look at the Hyades and you look at the Beehive Cluster and their motion, as you say, they're almost in phase with each other, in sync.
Yeah.
So yeah, it suggests they may possibly have had a similar origin. It's hard to it's very hard to
space estimates.
Yes. That was the bit that I meant to mention before. Which is that I say that proper motion is the term given for the apparent movement of things across the relative to the solar system. Mm-hmm. And the thing to I think the second half of that sentence is the important part, relative to the solar system. So we know that the solar system is moving through the Milky Way galaxy. So it's not the absolute motion of the object around the centre of the Milky Way.
Right.
So, but it's relative to us.
Yeah.
But then keeping in mind that we're moving at, you know, some number of kilometres per second through the galaxy.
Oh, so yeah, because if they might have consistent movement to each other, but the way that we're moving might make them look more in or more out of phase than they actually are.
Let me think through that. Not necessarily, more just that that if we say that this object is moving, because you can turn this, you know, 1 degree per century or whatever into kilometres per second if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And if we say it's moving at 35 kilometres per second, that's to note that it's relative to us, but we are ourselves moving at 60 kilometres per second around the galaxy.
Okay, so it in total is moving 60 kilometres plus.
Plus or minus, but also depending on the angle and things like that. So yes, that. So you don't really need that level of detail, but just to keep in mind that that's not the speed that it's necessarily moving through the galaxy, it's just the speed relative to us.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's a way too detailed answer for what is proper motion.
No, it's great. Thanks, Leon. Now, you said that there were two interesting things within Cancer.
Mm.
What's the second one?
Yes, well, two for like top of the list too.
Yeah.
There's probably many, many more. The other really exciting thing is a star.
Oh.
It's a very, very faint one within the constellation of Cancer.
Oh.
It's called 55 CNC. CNC is the abbreviation for Cancer.
Wow, or, snappy.
Yeah, or 55 Cancri.
Snappy.
Very good, yes.
Yeah. Crab claws. Snappy.
And the reason 55 Cancri is exciting is because it has five known planets.
Oh.
Now.
Exoplanets.
Exoplanets, yes. The two next levels of detail. Firstly, the star itself is not too dissimilar to the sun. So it's a bit smaller and a bit cooler.
Okay.
But it's still sun-like-ish.
In the scale of stars.
In the scale of stars.
It's pretty similar to ours.
It's not too far off. And
it's not UY Scooty.
No. from a few episodes back. Yeah, bigger than our solar system. Then the other exciting thing is, of these planets, one of them's really, really, really far away.
Okay.
It's about, you know, three times the size of Jupiter.
It's like the Neptune of our solar system.
No, we'll get to that.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, it's got three more that are too close to the star, and so they're really, really hot.
Mercury.
Yeah, they're actually closer to the star than one of them is actually closer to the star than Mercury is
to
our sun.
That's ridiculous.
Yes. However, right at about the distance of Earth to our sun, there is a planet
in the Goldilocks zone.
Oh, yes. So we call it the Goldilocks zone. Is the distance you need to be from a star where it's neither too hot,
because the porridge is not too hot.
No, it's
and
not,
it's
too,
not
cold.
Too cold.
It's just right. And just right in our classification is between 0 and 100 degrees Celsius,
where water can be a liquid.
Yes. Now, the interesting thing about this planet is that it is about the size of Neptune. So we don't think the planet itself is going to have oceans. It's probably a gas
giant.
However, Neptune has 14 moons. A couple of them are pretty big. So there's no shortage of speculation that this potential Neptune-sized planet around 55 CNC
might have
moons.
A livable moon.
Yeah, it might have ambient temperature moons. And that's really exciting.
That is exciting.
Now, we don't have any evidence of that yet, but you look at our solar system.
About.
Yeah, it's fun to think about, and that's exactly what you do. Theoretical science is just imagination plus maths.
Yeah.
And so you can do the maths, you can work out the probabilities and things like that, and yeah, it's a really exciting place to study.
Oh, that's it. That is interesting. Now, I noticed that you didn't mention the Crab Nebula.
No.
You would think, wouldn't you, that the Crab Nebula would be in the Crab constellation.
Not even close.
It is not.
Well, it's not too far
away.
It's in Taurus.
Yeah. Why is it Crab Nebula called the Crab Nebula if it's not in a crab?
oh, I think we covered this before. It's because...
Oh, we did. Yeah. I think this was in like the very first... I think that the Crab Nebula was my first space picture of the month, actually.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember saying at the time that in the days when the Crab Nebula was discovered, they didn't have photography.
Yeah.
So they would draw what they saw. And the first guy to discover the Crab Nebula couldn't draw for shit. And so his drawing ended up looking like a crab.
Okay, so the Crab Nebula is called the Crab Nebula because it looks like a crab, but it is not in the crab. It is not related to the sky crab.
And it doesn't look like a crab.
It doesn't look like
a
crab.
In modern telescopes.
Okay.
So, but the name stuck.
Yeah.
Remember I said astronomy has a lot of bad jargon?
Yeah. Crab Nebula, one of those.
Crab Nebula, one of them.
So talking of jargon and silly names for things, I've got a couple of points about our star names in Cancer. They're quite dim, so like we said, they're not... not super exciting,
mm-hmm.
Except Zeta Cancri, or Zeta, is called a tegmine, which means the shell.
Oh, that's handy.
Which is very, very fitting. But then Delta and Gamma Cancri are known as Acellus Australis and Acellus Borealis.
Oh, okay, so something north and something south.
Yep. Donkey.
The northern donkey and the southern donkey.
Yep.
Oh, there you go. What language is that from? Obviously that's Latin.
I mean, that's Latin, yeah.
Yeah, well, sorry, I guess what culture?
Genuinely, no idea. It's a little bit weird as well, because if you go to Babylonian, Delta Cancri, this is sort of slightly, it maybe has the record for the longest star name, because in, apparently, Babylonian... I've written this out phonetically, so we'll see how it goes. Mm-hmm. I don't speak Babylonian, so I'm sorry if I murder this. Delta Cancri is also known as Arkashanangarushashutu.
Wow, that's quite a name.
Which means the southeastern star in the crab. Nothing to do with the donkey at all. So I don't know where the donkeys have come from.
Wow, that's really interesting. Okay.
I don't know where these Latin donkeys are from, Leon.
So we're looking for a Y-shaped pattern of stars that is a crab, but also two of those stars are donkeys.
Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right, I'm happy to roll with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Crab Nebula, not in the crab. The crab is a crab, has...
beehives.
Beehives, but also... something that is known as a nebulous mass in the breast of the crab,
mm-hmm.
And two donkeys, and a shell.
Love it.
There is also one more, which is X Cancri.
X Cancri. Oh, that's Chi?
Yeah, but it's X Cancri. Oh. sorry, I'm making like a little arm motion. It just feels very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Which is apparently the reddest star in the sky. Which is probably partly why it's quite hard to see.
Oh, I'm curious what metric reddest is. And there are actual metrics in astronomy. I'd love to see the data on that.
Yeah, like I did try and look into it, but again, it's one of those things where I think that there are probably four or five stars that could be the reddest, mm-hmm. depending on who you ask and depending on what the weather's doing on that evening.
There's things like the U minus B number, and I think those are the depending on how much.
Yeah,
because you don't just get perfect uniform color from a star, like all the colors of the rainbow.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get more red and more blue, and then you can quantify that with.
Yeah, well, it's like saying the biggest.
The B you minus could, V, that's what it's called.
Yeah, you could have the biggest by height, length, mass. Like, there's so many ways that you can quantify biggest. Mm. So, like, and that's just not even talking about space. That's just in life in general. Like, what is the biggest?
Yeah, so, you can find something unique about everything to make it the most of something.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Like there's no uninteresting numbers.
Yeah,
but you list out all the uninteresting ones, and one of them is going to be the smallest. So it's the smallest uninteresting number. That's interesting.
But yeah, I just thought that it was a fun point that it is apparently the reddest star in the sky.
Cool.
Don't know what it means, but go out, have a look, see if you think it's redder.
All right, I'm going to do some reading about that.
So, I think that's everything we've got to say about crabs.
I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, now...
I want to talk about spaceships.
Do you want to talk about spaceships or people on spaceships? Bit of both?
Bit of both,
Bit of both?
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, really, what we want to cover, this is Space Flight Focus, by the way.
Yeah, Space Flight Focus. Still going to sing my own jingles.
Let's go. 2, 1, we have a liftoff.
Just to cover the fact that you would have seen by now that at last the two astronauts, Butch and Suni, who have been on the International Space Station for about 9 months now, returned home.
Yes.
As of this recording, it was last week. And yes, they made their way back.
Featured in our space fail several months ago.
Yeah, space
about
fail.
9 months ago.
Yeah, so to quickly recap, they went up on the test flight of the Boeing Starliner, mm-hmm. which was a NASA wants many alternative vehicles on which they can launch humans.
Yes.
So if one stops working, the other one can come and do the job.
Yep.
And so, yeah, they went up on the Boeing Starliner test flight. And on the way up, they had some troubles with their thrusters.
Yeah.
And ultimately, NASA didn't want to bring them back in the Starliner.
Yes. I would say that mission was a partial success rather than a partial failure because everyone was safe.
Yeah.
No one was hurt, but also the ship was not quite fit for purpose.
No, that's right. Now, for what it's worth, it did safely come back to Earth with nobody on board.
Yes, but not worth the risk.
No, that's right. NASA has learned not... Yeah,
the hard
NASA
way.
NASA does not do risks with people's lives anymore.
No.
They outsource it. One level of laundering. yeah, it's interesting. I guess I wanted to cover that the media coverage has been pretty sloppy. I know you've got stuff to say about this
yeah.
as well. But the thing has always been like, stranded on the ISS. And like, the ISS has other spacecraft, like Soyuz spacecraft
yeah.
on board
I mean,
for the event of an emergency. So
yeah.
if they absolutely had to come home, there was options.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, there's certain things about the context which are like, this wasn't great. Like, the fact that they got sent up and, I mean, anyone, if you were sent on a work trip for 8 days and you came home 9 months later, that is not exactly an ideal situation. But also stuff like their luggage got taken off the flight as well. So it was like, because you're only going to be there for 8 days. And it's like, yeah, you know what? I can cope. And then you're there for 9 months. But also, it wasn't like they were there completely isolated for 9 months. Like, they could have come home if it was needed, but they got roped. Like, they
got allocated to the next mission.
Yeah, they got allocated to the next mission. Their stuff got to them because they were like, well, you're going to be there for a while. So now we'll send spacesuits up
yeah.
for you.
Yeah,
you know,
personal items and things.
Yeah, exactly. So they weren't abandoned with yeah. a week's clothing on a spaceship.
No,
like,
that's right.
Yeah,
the space station is pretty well stocked. And so, yeah, what NASA ended up doing was the next mission, which was going to be a SpaceX launch with
yep.
four astronauts,
yep.
got reduced to two.
Like what? And it was also always intended to be a 7 or 8 month mission.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was going to go up in sort of second half of last year.
Yeah.
And it did, but they took two of the astronauts off, who I'm sure are not salty about that
no.
at all. And then, yeah, so the Crew 9 went up, and then, yeah, it performed its 6 month mission,
yep.
which Butch and Suni were allocated to.
Yes, yeah, so they were doing thousands of hours of research
yes.
while they were up there. They weren't just chilling on the ISS
yeah.
either.
And then they came back. And that was all planned, like once they realized they were going to be up there,
yeah.
NASA made this whole plan. So despite what the two morons in the big white building are saying, that was all organized. It wasn't like anyone was incompetent or anything like that.
No.
Yeah, so
yeah.
interesting stuff.
Yeah, so this, talking about the morons, kind of brings me to another part that I wanted to talk about, and this is one that I don't think is a segment. I think that occasionally, maybe once every 6 months, Beth gets salty about something.
Oh, okay.
The media coverage of the astronauts' return has been lovely in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
We're all very happy that the astronauts are back. I feel a little bit sorry for the other two folks who were on the Crew 9 mission,
like
who went up into space, did their job, and whose names I genuinely don't know, because they got back to Earth absolutely just fine. They had no problems with their mission. And they have been entirely ignored in the media coverage. But
it's Nick Hague and Alexander Gorbunov.
Thank you, Leon. Did you know those off the top of your head, though?
I used to.
Okay, fine. I didn't.
Anyway.
But, yeah, this is what I mean, though. Like, their names have barely come up in the media coverage, which I don't think is very fair to them, because they did a good job, and they went to space, which is awesome. But also, like, there's been a lot of discussion about the effects of space on one's body as a result of this mission. But it's been specifically because of Suni.
Mm-hmm.
So
Suni being
the
woman?
a woman, yes, the female astronaut who was on this mission. And so much of the media coverage has been like, look at how skinny she looks now. Look at how old she looks now. And it's like, yeah, babe, because she didn't dye her hair, because she thought she was going to be up there for a week. And now she's been there for 9 months. So her grays have come through. Like, she is, oh, it's so frustrating. Just because, like, you haven't heard any of that about Butch. Like, it's none of it has been like, ooh, he looks like he's lost some muscle mass. Like, none of that at all. It was like, did you see how thin her wrist looked? Like, did you see how old she looks now? Like, ooh, her cheeks have hollowed. And it's like, yeah, because these are the well-documented effects of prolonged periods of low gravity on astronauts. Like, this is not a new thing. Yeah, you lose muscle mass. We know that. Like, you quite often lose weight as well. And it's something that astronauts work really hard on. And they are going into rehab, as all astronauts do, not just these guys, because they thought they were going to be there for a short amount of time and were there longer. Like, this is stuff that has always happened, but now it's suddenly getting front page media coverage because a lady now looks too thin and grey and aged, and like, now people are freaking out and being like, oh, space ages you. And I'm like...
And it distracts from the awesomeness of the work that they did while they were there.
Yeah, and like, also... stuff, and the reason that this links to certain individuals in a White House is that, like, even their commentary, like, Suni is a decorated military veteran, which normally means a lot. Like, she was a naval, I think, captain. Like,
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, she's a...
It wasn't a joy flight or...
It wasn't a joy flight. She is a professional, she is a scientist, she is ex-military, and like... all that's being covered is like, oh, she's quite grey now, isn't she? So it's just like, so just, I find that very frustrating that this has been taken in that way. I don't think it's a bad thing that we are educating the public on the consequences of spaceflight. I think that it's a good thing that we know that it's not just a jaunty little joyride up into space, especially as we are talking more and more about, like, space tourism and commercialization. Like, people should know if you're going to spend 9 months in low gravity that you're going to have to work really hard or you're going to lose muscle mass. Maybe you can't dye your hair in space, you know, but it's just the context that it's been presented in.
Yeah, like, this is somehow a new thing.
Yeah, like, it's somehow... Also, like... why this in particular? Because female astronauts have been on the ISS before.
It's a bit strange.
Yeah. So this is my getting salty platform.
Beth gets salty.
Yeah.
I'm a stinger for that.
It'll be a rare one, but it'll be a good one when it is.
It's worth pointing out there has actually already been a study called the Twin Study, where they two identical twin astronauts, Scott Kelly and Mark Kelly.
Yeah.
And Scott Kelly went up to the space station for 12 months, so longer than Butch and Suni.
A whole year?
A whole year in space. And, yeah, they studied him and his brother, who was back on Earth.
Yeah.
Or stayed down on Earth. And they compared the two. And, yeah, so it was great because they were able to have a benchmark of a dude on Earth and then a year in space and see what effect that had on the human body.
Yeah, and also, like, when you are a NASA astronaut being paid for it, like, they can really, really control those situations as well, like, actually feeding them the same food, like, giving them the same exercise routine, like, you know, it was detailed.
Yes.
And so super controlled study, like, we know the differences that space has on the human body. But yeah, so I am really, really glad that more people know now about the differences that space can have on the human body. But we didn't already know that if you don't dye your hair for 9 months, it can show through your greys. So I don't know why this is an important part of the news cycle.
It's worth pointing out that Beth has, like, peach dyed hair with pink streaks.
So it was originally bright pink dyed hair, but has faded because I did not dye it for 6 months.
Yeah, and I can see the actual natural colour coming through.
Yeah. So,
yeah, there you go. Yeah,
I know
that's
about
what happens
hair dye.
it's just chemistry and biology.
Yeah, exactly. Her hair grew and it grew back slightly grey.
Whoa.
Oh, no. Better make it front page news. Oh, my God, space ages
NASA
you.
NASA discovers aging. This does lead me to a question that we got for the burning question or space question of the month.
Yes, yes. So in my research of, like, what happened to the astronauts, one of the things that had come up, again, was a little bit that we're sort of edging around, is the placement of blame upon various organizations and various individuals. And there was a change in organization and individuals in America during this space flight. Mm-hmm. And that got me thinking, how do astronauts vote?
Yeah. How do they? I genuinely hadn't really thought about this until it popped up the other day.
Yeah, I turned around in the office and I was like, Leon, how do astronauts vote? And we're like, we don't know. Okay, let's find out. And I thought it was going to be really interesting, and it's actually really not.
Is it just like they send an email?
Basically, yeah.
Was that
it? So NASA has published information on this because NASA astronauts have voted in space before. There isn't detail about how precisely it was done this time. So this is still like a slightly open question. But in general, the way that astronauts vote, NASA astronauts specifically, so this is American astronauts, they can use absentee ballots or early voting. So most astronauts live in or near Houston. Mm-hmm. Because that's where mission control is, so that's where like most of their training and, you know.
Yeah, all of that. The astronaut village.
Yeah, so because most of them live there, that's where most of them vote. So that's also quite helpful because then you don't need to deal with like trying to get votes to multiple different, like, and America's do caucuses and all that sort of, and yeah. So mostly it is just like one county that is dealing with astronaut votes as well, which
that's handy.
Does definitely smooth things. So normally before you take off, you have to fill in a federal postcard application. And this is where it gets a little bit weird in my open-ended at the end, but we'll come back to that.
Okay.
So you fill in your federal postcard application, and then when you are on the space station, it literally just uses the SCAN network, which is the Space Communications and Navigations Network.
Yep.
So the astronaut fills out an electronic ballot, which is super, super encrypted. It goes through their tracking and data relay satellite system to a ground antenna in New Mexico. That then gets transferred to Mission Control at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, and then it goes to the county responsible. And so the clerk in the county opens the vote and files it.
There you go.
Yeah, that's it.
Wow. So it's kind of as boring as you'd expect.
Yeah, they just vote from space.
Yeah.
And so the first time that this happened, so Texas specifically passed a law to allow this to happen in 1997.
Oh.
So the first, I think that was, it was known that there would be an astronaut heading up who would be in space over the election period.
Right.
So that was David Wolf was the first astronaut to vote in 1997.
Oh, there you go.
Other countries have done things slightly differently. Not all of them are very open about how they allow this process to happen, which is, of course, absolutely understandable. Mm-hmm. However, so I had a little bit of a look into how the cosmonauts, or the Russian astronauts, have voted. Once, they just straight up radioed who their vote was down to Mission Control, and I guess just hoped that they would submit their votes as expected.
Uh-huh.
And that, and then also Russia had an option for digital voting in one of their elections. I think that may, however, have been the election where Putin won 140% of the votes.
Ah, right.
So I don't know how reliable the digital voting system
the
was.
Most reliable.
But, yeah, digital voting system, so it's all encrypted data through satellite relays because the modern world allows that to happen.
Yeah, there you go.
So,
I'm just reminded of, what was his name? The astronaut on Apollo 13 who forgot to do his tax return before he left.
Yes.
And had to get a special exemption to...
Yeah, yeah. Because it's like, you didn't file your taxes. I was in space.
Yes.
I'm sorry. But very important part of my research was a federal postcard application is filled in prior to departure.
Yes. I see where this is going.
Yes.
Suppose you are only planning on being in space for a week.
You wouldn't fill in a federal postcard application, would you, Leon?
You probably wouldn't.
No.
So, hypothetically, suppose two astronauts launched to space, you know, middle of last year.
Yeah.
Planning on going there for 8 days.
Yeah.
Didn't fill in a postal thing and accidentally ended up staying in there for 9 months.
Over the election period.
Yeah.
I genuinely don't know.
Yes.
Like,
how did Butch and Sunni vote? That's the question.
Yeah. Yeah. So if anyone knows, if they were, because I don't know if they just wouldn't be allowed to, because America has different laws from Australia as well. This is always something I forget, because I can't vote here because I'm not a citizen.
Ah.
So here, people have to vote.
Yes.
So I don't know how, and I did have a look at like how Australian astronauts vote, but it hasn't been necessary to work it out yet. No. So that probably means it just hasn't been worked out yet. But it also, because Australia has mandatory voting, your voting periods are a lot longer as well. Mm. So like you can vote in advance a lot easier. Okay. And I know that in the UK, for me, I can still vote in the UK, but I have a proxy vote. So it's literally my mate who I'm just like, hey, can you please vote for this party?
On your behalf,
and I just tell him and he is licensed to vote on my behalf. And I've just got to trust that he puts who I want to. But he also wouldn't be my mate if he was going to vote for the people that I really didn't want. So, yeah.
You come across as a real Tory supporter.
Yeah. No, not even in jest, Leon, please. Other nations haven't had to work this out yet. But also, like, Butch and Sunny wouldn't have been punished for not voting, so they wouldn't have been fined in the US because it is voluntary. But also, I don't know if they would have wanted to.
Yeah.
And all of the research that I've found, like all of the information that NASA has put out about their astronauts, they all talk about how like the next astronaut to vote in space is going to be. Rather than from a previous election cycle, or it's like the last person who voted in space, and it's all still a bit out of date, probably because they've been busy getting their astronauts back rather than writing pieces about whether or not they voted. I genuinely don't know if they did or not because they couldn't fill out that federal postcard application. So my question wasn't directly answered because I wanted to know how they voted.
Right.
But I do now know in general
how most astronauts vote. Wow, there you go.
So, yeah.
I feel we've learned something.
I think I have.
Speaking of that, it wasn't quite a fail on anyone's behalf, but
uh-oh.
I would like to talk about a space fail of the month.
Space fail of the month, let's go.
Yes.
Space fail of the month.
So last month we covered that there was going to be an attempted moon landing.
Yes.
By the Firefly Blue Ghost.
Ah, yes.
And it was a great success. It landed on the moon.
Hey.
And it did some experiments. This is part of the NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services program,
yep.
CLPS. And, great success. It's finished now. It was a 14-day mission.
Okay.
The reason for 14 days is that's how long a day lasts on the moon.
Yep.
And then the batteries can't survive 14 days of lunar night.
So, right.
But that was a great success. At the same time, we only very, very briefly mentioned it.
Yes.
There was a second mission on the CLPS program going up.
Athena,
as part of a company, on behalf of a company called Intuitive Machines.
Yes. So the first one was Odysseus, was it?
So, yes. This time last year, February 2024,
yep.
Intuitive Machines launched their first attempted moon landing, IM-1, as it was called, mm-hmm. and that was nicknamed Odysseus.
Mm-hmm.
And it came down to land on the lunar south pole, and it landed a bit too hard, and it broke its leg, and it fell over, and that was the end of the mission.
Bless it.
So they tried again this time, this year.
Okay.
So, yes, just to clarify, as I said, we had the Firefly Blue Ghost, successful,
yep.
and then here comes Intuitive Machines for their second attempted landing on the moon. Their first one broke its leg and fell over.
This segment is not called Space Success of the Month.
No.
So,
here we go again.
Oh, no.
It,
Intuitive Machines.
It broke its leg and fell over.
Oh, again.
A little bit more complicated than that. But, yes, it did not successfully touchdown. When you land on the moon, if you crash into the moon and explode, it's called a hard landing.
Right.
If you touch down successfully on the moon, it's called a soft landing.
Yeah.
And so this was what you would call a hard soft landing. As the spacecraft came into land, because all of this is automated, there's no people on board,
mm-hmm.
but there's also no one sitting like with a joystick on Earth.
Okay.
Because the light travel time to send, you know, fly left to get to the moon is more than a second.
Long.
Yeah, it's too long. So this all has to be automated. And as this spacecraft came into land, the engines kicked up a whole plume of lunar dust and it confused their altimeter, and the altimeter lost track of how high am I above the surface.
That's not good.
And then the spacecraft kind of lost its bearings, tipped over, and then its engines were still firing, and it kind of pushed itself along the ground for like 40, 50 metres, and then it ended up in a crater on its side, and in doing so broke its legs and things like that. The analogy they've given is a bit like a baseballer sliding to the home base.
Right.
Yeah, coming in and dust, kick up, slide,
and
all of that dust that then settled on the solar panels, so they couldn't get any power. So they did, I think it was able to work for a few hours on what limited battery it had.
Yeah,
but that was an unsuccessful attempt at landing on the moon. The second one by Intuitive Machines.
Now, I think that they did this to themselves because of their unintuitive naming system.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. Odysseus and then Athena? Come on, like, choose another member of the Odyssey.
Oh, I see.
It doesn't, like, yeah, yeah, vaguely, but, like, you've gone for one Greek hero and then one goddess?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
it's,
no.
It's a bit strange.
Come on. So I think that next time, right, if they pick a theme, they'll have more success.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. All right. Which is why the Artemis missions to the moon are going to go great.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Apollo missions, awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, was named after the god of the sun, so maybe was set up a little bit for failure in the beginning there. Mm-hmm. This time, Artemis, goddess of the moon, amazing. Apollo's twin sister, amazing. First time we're sending women up in Artemis, oh, yes. That'll go very well.
Right. As we spoke about a month or two ago, that Artemis 2 has been pushed out until the end of next year.
So that it works.
Ah, right.
I think that this is something important in space in general, though. Successful delays, mm-hmm, are so much better than rushed failures.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
That is where I'm standing. So yeah, I think intuitive machines should name things better.
There we go.
And then they might have more luck.
You can tell them that.
I will.
When you are...
When I'm emailing them about naming of Saturn's moons.
Yeah, you, yeah.
Yeah, I'll also tell them to pass along to their friends at intuitive machines.
I do... This is like spoiler, maybe, oh, but I want to move on to Space Picture of the Month.
Move on? Like moon?
Oh. Moon von. only because once I explain what picture I have for you...
Oh, all will become clear?
All will become clear.
Okay, let's have a look.
So we haven't done Space Picture of the Month for a while.
No.
So it's where we send each other pictures and we try and describe it for you, the listener.
A great radio segment.
Yes. And so here's your attempt, Beth. I would like for you to describe to everybody. What is this? What are you seeing?
Oh, I was really hoping that it was going to be a picture of a little moon rover on its side waving its little leggies in the air. I think that this looks like an eclipse. So what I'm seeing is a mostly black image, and sort of in the top centre, a ring of light, but it looks like a coffee mug ring shape. So, like... If you leave a coffee mug on a table and it gets that little ring stain around the bottom, so it's like there's clearly a ring shape, but you've also got some little coffee
like
droplets.
Details.
Yeah. Yep. So when we talk about this small circle in the sort of if we're talking clock face, at about 11 o'clock, there's like a tiny little brighter section. And then at sort of between 3 and 5 o'clock, there's a really, really bright section.
This looks like a diamond ring, perhaps.
Oh, a diamond ring.
I'm just like trying to get some visual clues.
Yeah. Okay, but like a diamond ring, if you turn your head.
Yeah, it's tilted on its side. Yeah.
So yeah, and I say it looks like an eclipse because there's this little ring of light, but it's like a very perfect circle with the detail.
Yep.
Now this does have a caption, this picture, which I've not read.
Oh. I'm not looking at the caption.
No, I didn't either until I literally I genuinely didn't even look at it just now, and then at the bottom, I don't know if it's just teams like auto-generating description.
Must be embedded in the metadata.
Yeah. So I could read what it is, but I'll let you tell me.
Sure. Maybe I'll just read the caption. I didn't realise that. This is, you're right, it's an eclipse.
Ah.
And when I say eclipse, most people's idea of that springs to mind as the moon passing in front of the sun.
Yep.
And yeah, we get the sun peaks around the edge of the moon and we get this diamond ring in the sky.
Yeah.
This is an eclipse, but it is an eclipse as seen from the moon.
So it's a lunar eclipse in a different sense.
Yes, it is.
An eclipse from lunar, not by lunar.
That's right. So yes, this is in fact a lunar eclipse, which happened in early March. And when we see a lunar eclipse on Earth, that's when we get the blood moon.
Yes.
And as it happened, there was a blood moon eclipse in early March. And as it happens, there was a spacecraft on the moon during that eclipse, and it's looking at it. So that diamond ring and that dark patch is the Earth blocking out the sun on the moon.
Whoa.
And that ring we can see is the sunlight scattering through Earth's atmosphere.
Oh.
And that little bright, that bright region, that diamond that I'm trying to suggest,
yes,
is just the last little shred of the sun before the totality occurs.
Oh, wow.
And so this was a picture taken by the successful moon lander,
oh,
the Firefly Blue Ghost.
Good job, Blue Ghost.
Yeah,
it happened to be,
yeah, on the moon as the eclipse happened. And yeah, so this is an eclipse from the moon.
That's awesome. Oh, that's so cool. It's very pretty as well.
It is. It's quite, it's one of those, like, one for the books. Like, this is, yeah, space.
That, yeah, yeah.
Space, that's it.
Space. Well, I mean, it's like the Cassini,
The Cassini
Saturn,
ones, yeah.
Saturn Earth, it's like, it's one of those, like, everyone who's ever existed is in this picture.
Oh, it is
kind
too,
of moments.
Yeah.
Every time I look at a picture of Earth from space, that's what I think about.
Yeah.
Just me over romanticizing space. Well, I have a picture for you.
Okay.
Okay, this isn't the real picture. This is just me being a little bit silly.
This is the Greater Western Sydney AFLW team, isn't it?
Maybe.
It's a it's a team photo of they've got the Greater Western Sydney uniform on.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, it is.
and yeah, it's the women's team, AFLW.
the new names of Saturn's moons, maybe? No.
Oh, right. Yes, of course.
Here's the actual picture that I want to send you. Okay.
Ooh, okay.
Now, Leon does actually know what this is because I asked him if he knew about it, and it turns out he didn't. But please describe anyway. Or, I mean, just throwing it out there, we had a little bit of producer voice at the very beginning.
Oh,
does the producer
want to try
and
describe,
describe a picture?
I can.
Hey, Morgan.
All right. Morgan, take it away.
All right, we've got an image that looks like quite a close-up of what I would call macaroni cheese and blueberries.
Oh.
I was thinking blueberries too.
Mm.
Yeah, okay, I see
with
that.
With the colour of macaroni cheese. It
so
says
like,
on
instead of macaroni, it's blueberry cheese.
Yeah, blueberry cheese, exactly okay. That. I think it's a close-up of a rock, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good job. Well done.
Thank you.
Thanks, Morgan.
Thanks, Morgan. it really does look like blueberries thrown on top of cheesy pasta.
Yeah, it does. It does now look like blueberry cheese. So, this is a relatively new image from NASA. Now, I found this because I was just scrolling through NASA's news blog, and they got me with the clickbait, but it wasn't actually that baity at all, because the title of this, who's written by a PhD candidate at Imperial College London, so well done, Alex Jones, you got me, the title was Shocking Spherules, and I was like, oh, what?
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, this is a rock that is made up of, like, literally millimeter-sized tiny spheres that all appear to be stuck together. Hmm. So this image is from Perseverance. It is a fusion process super camera remote micro-imager mosaic.
What planet is this on?
So this is on Mars.
It's on Mars, just to clarify.
Yeah, it's on Mars, sorry.
Is the robot on Mars?
Yes. So this is from the Jezero Crater Rim. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a rock just made out of hundreds of tiny spheres.
Mm. And that's weird because that's not what most rocks look like, at least the rocks that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, so there's another picture showing this rock in situ. And this rock looks out of place because all of the rocks around it are sort of like quite flat, quite like not like smooth, but they're
like
still rocks.
Weathered.
Like big slabs.
Mm.
So, you know, they've got like a couple layers in them, but they're all like slabby layers. And they're all quite pale. They almost look sandstone-y, like sandstone-y, limestone-y kind of colour.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got
this
big,
thing.
Grey, bubbly rock just sat there. And
that's
so
very strange.
Yeah, so it's not the first time that blueberry cheese has been found on Mars.
Okay.
So in 2004, exploration, the Mars exploration rover Opportunity saw what they called Martian blueberries. So you were spot on, Morgan. Good job.
Yeah.
He's raising his own eyebrows at himself. It's like, oh, I did a good job. Yes, you did. But that was at a different location on Mars. So
yeah,
that
yeah.
was at Meridiani Planum.
Yeah.
It's different. And then Curiosity. This is not the first time that... Yeah, so Curiosity also found some spherules.
Right.
Perseverance itself has also seen...
Oh, it's not the first time even Perseverance has seen them.
No, and also not even in Jezero. So the same crater mm-hmm. that this was found in, but not in the same place.
Mm.
So in those cases... So the three previous cases that we found these like weird bobbly rocks, it's been thought that the spheres were formed by groundwater circulating through pore spaces. So like washing away and forming around like harder aspects of rock. And then,
yeah, okay.
Yeah. But on Earth, sometimes spherules are formed by molten rock droplets rapidly cooling after volcanic activity. And I'm quoting Alex here, the condensation of rock vaporized by a meteorite impact.
Yeah,
and it was found at the edge of a crater.
Yeah, I'm just thinking because it looks so out of place on the background.
Yeah, so that's what's really different about this time to the other three times. Like the other three times, it kind of made sense. It wasn't the only thing that was that sort of color and shape and yeah, but this one. It's just like, why is it there?
Yeah, it is very strange. And it's interesting because, yeah, the fact that Curiosity and Opportunity and Perseverance are in three very different places on Mars.
Yeah.
Like, almost on opposite sides of the planet, because, you know, why not?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this clearly indicates either a planet-sized process, such as volcanic activity,
yeah,
or something that occurs randomly and mm-hmm. therefore could equally occur with equal probability anywhere on the planet. So, yeah.
Or ancient Martians making their kitchen surfaces out of a really desirable bubbly rock.
That too.
That's just one of those things that I think of when, you know, like, will archaeologists thousands of years in the future find, like, marble from the Middle East in Australian homes on kitchen yeah. countertops and be like, how did this get there? How did it form? And it's like, because all of the rest of the kitchen has disappeared and, like, all that's left is this granite countertop. And it's like, why is this perfectly even, smooth, polished granite slab here yeah. so far away from the major deposits? That's just a thing I think about sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very strange future for archaeologists of the future. Yeah, there you go. So spherules on Mars.
Spherules.
Or shocking spherules.
Shocking spherules.
Yes. Well, more science is needed because, yeah, as you say, there's those many mechanisms that could do that, but without... knowing more, it's kind of hard to pin down. Was it volcanoes? Or there hasn't been super active volcanic activity on Mars for quite a while, if I remember. But also, nothing else has happened on Mars for quite a while either. So it could have been sitting there for a billion years.
Yeah, maybe.
So I love that quote from The Martian. If you kick that rock, it hasn't moved for a million years. Climb a hill, first guy to do that.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess this month, we've had a couple of... Or I've had a couple more, like, open-ended questions.
Mm.
Which kind of brings us to the last question that I have, which is, what do you think?
How we doing?
How we doing? What do you think of the podcast? Do you like it?
Yeah, what Beth is trying to do is, if you're listening to this podcast, we'd actually love some feedback. So what Beth is trying to say is that if you're listening to this podcast... we'd love to hear some feedback from you.
Yeah.
The best way to do that is to just message us at ParticleWA on Instagram, and you can say what you want, whether you like the format, whether you want specific content included, or more of this, please, less of that, please.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'd just really love to know. We're looking to make the podcast a bit more, not a bit more, but, you know, to expand what we do, and we'd love to know what you want. Because
we want to make sure that we're not going like, well, we really like this bit, so we're going to do more of that.
Yeah.
And it turns out that you guys are like, that's my least favourite part of the podcast. I wish they wouldn't. And, I mean, I think that the best possible outcome of this is that everyone dislikes all parts of the podcast equally, which means we won't change anything, because it means that we're annoying everyone equally as much, which I think is a measure of success.
That's true. If you don't have Instagram, you can also get in touch by email. It's literally just particle@scitech.org.au.
There you go.
So yeah, either particlewa on Instagram or particle@scitech.org.au.
Yeah, but drop us an email. Drop us your thoughts.
Slide into our DMs. Yeah, all of that. But I think that is probably enough time for now. I've had a time and a half, Beth. How about you?
Yeah, I've had a pretty good time as well. Producer Morgan, have you had a good time?
Yeah, it's been a run.
It has been a run.
I've had a good time.
And thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll see you next month. What are we going to do next month, Beth?
We're going to be looking at the night sky in May.
May. Oof, you even raised your eyebrows when you said that. Something exciting might be going on.
I was just like, it's so unpredictable that we're going to do May after April.
I think I'm done here.
Thanks, Leon.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear more interesting space news, check out the website particle.scitech.org.au for more information.